You're listening to the West Wing Weekly. I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. This is episode 2 of the West Wing Weekly.
And all the skeptics and the spreaders of doom said we wouldn't reach this milestone, but Rishi, here we are. Episode 2. We did it.
I think the only person who was spreading doom to me was you.
Yeah. Nevertheless, despite my cynicism, we made it.
We did. Our pilot got picked up by us.
Exactly. That's what it is. I'm an actor, so just getting to episode 2, oh my God, that rarely happens. And yet we've done it.
And so did the West Wing. This is their first episode after getting picked up. It's called Post Hoc Ergo Propter Hoc.
Yes. Aaron Sorkin obviously consumed with regret at having titled the pilot, Pilot. Was like, what can I do to grossly overcompensate for that simple first episode title? He's like, I know, I'll throw out some Latin.
27 lawyers in the room. Anybody know post hoc, ergo, propter hoc? Josh?
Post, after hoc, ergo, therefore, after hoc, therefore, something else hoc.
All the things that we talked about on the pilot, that there are certain difficulties that you have just because you have to establish characters. You don't get to, like, rely on things. At this point, the show's already in full force by episode 2.
I completely agree. And so without having to establish everyone and give us that little quick nugget of exposition, just telling us who each person is, he gets to actually now tease out elements of their personalities. And we see Brad Whitford / Josh Lyman's comic chops, and everybody gets to sort of dig in a little bit in this second episode.
There is one important introduction that happens, though, and that's the introduction of the vice president, played by Tim Matheson, Vice President Hoynes.
Vice President Otter.
Otter, exactly.
Right.
Otter from Animal House.
I think this situation absolutely requires a really futile and stupid gesture be done on somebody's part.
We're just the guys to do it.
To people of a certain age, that age being my age, which is 50, you can't see him on screen. And a great actor, but that's Otter.
But now he's all grown up and he's John Hoynes. And we don't know too much about his backstory yet. And, you know, every president and vice president, they have each relationship is unique. This one is not such a friendly one.
No, apparently not.
And I think it's supposed to be modeled after the contentious JFK-LBJ relationship. I feel like the Obama-Biden presidency and vice presidency, at least the way they present it, it really seems like Biden is like a very trusted advisor for him.
And that's what Leo's looking for or wants out of Hoynes. I think Leo says he wants full-throated support for his president from Vice President Hoynes, and he's not getting it.
As we figured out in the last episode, the president does not have great polling numbers. He doesn't have a lot of support. He's not in a strong position politically. And Lloyd Russell is looking at maybe challenging him from within the party. And now it seems like even his own vice president is going to be doing the same thing.
Yes. Yeah, so let me ask you this. One of the things that amused me as I watched is that with Aaron, a fair amount of the time, Aaron Sorkin will write things where you're not quite sure what's being referred to. A3C3? Is this either a game of Battleship or something that I couldn't identify?
We certainly don't find out what it is in the episode. And as far as I can tell, it's not a thing in the real world. But that doesn't stop it from getting all kinds of nicknames. It's A3C3. Sometimes it's just referred to as A3.
A3, sure.
And sometimes it's referred to, Hoynes calls it later, AC cubed.
Ah, nice. I'm delighted to discover that it's not just me, and we really don't know what this thing is. And we don't really need to, which is sort of the cleverness of Aaron, which is we just know there's something. Let's call it A3C3. And
and keen listeners might remember it from the pilot episode. It actually gets a mention briefly in one line from CJ.
There might be a press leak on A3C3.
And Hoynes has released an unacceptable quote about it that seems to be a shot at the president.
A short while ago, the vice president commented on the White House position on the A3C3, saying, and I'm quoting from notes, "This is a time when the president needs our support."
And then the writer is like,
"Can you clarify the language?"
And I guess Aaron's answer is no. I can't.
Right.
And I'm not going to.
Can't and I shan't.
Yeah. So it's somewhat irrelevant. The real thing is that, like, they took a position, and Hoynes gave this weird, ambiguous answer that he didn't back them up.
And right, when CJ presses him on it, he completely blows her off and basically says, look, I have my own press secretary, and just walks on by.
Yeah. He's pretty dismissive. I mean, he has this like really nice, pleasant diplomatic exchange in French. But then when CJ comes and talks to him really politely, he's basically a dick.
Yes, I would say so. And although the CJ, to her credit, sort of covers for him, she doesn't want to get into it with Leo. Leo seems to sense that that Hoynes has given her the high hat, as it were. But she says, no, I talked to him and everything's fine. But it's going to lead to Leo with his deep insight. He knows his CJ, and he knows, he sort of divines what probably happened and calls Hoynes in, calls him to task and brings him into his office and dresses him down in no uncertain terms.
Yeah, this is a part that I thought is interesting, and it's like a nice view what actually happens within the West Wing and how things are disseminated to the press or not. Because the reason why CJ kind of plays it down to Leo is Josh, Sam, and CJ have a conversation about it after they find out about it, and Sam thinks they need to make sure that Leo does not get involved.
Listen, make sure CJ keeps this off Leo's desk.
I think it goes right on Leo's desk.
A vague quote from Hoynes will disappear by the end of the next news cycle. A fistfight between Leo and the vice president's got juice.
Fair point.
Internal strife within the administration between the chief of staff and the vice presidency, that's like a sexy story that makes them look bad too.
Right, and they've got media problems.
Right.
And in that scene, ultimately, between Leo and Hoynes, Leo sort of seems to imply that keep this up and we might just get rid of you, kind of thing.
And that's understandable, right? Because if Hoynes is looking to make a challenge for the nomination from within the party is one thing, but to be challenged from your own vice president before your second term comes, that's like, maybe it's not unheard of. It's pretty crazy, though. I mean,
but is that made explicit? Is that the...
It is not made explicit, but I think that's what's being implied, is that Hoynes saying that, gearing up to start campaigning.
Positioning himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Positioning himself. Gotcha. All that said, are there really teeth to the threat that they're going to get rid of the vice president? Because I think the vice president is really the only cabinet member that can't be fired. In other words, he would have to be impeached.
Aha, that's right.
All the other cabinet members serve at the pleasure, as they say. And I think the vice president I think the House would have to vote, and you'd have to get 2/3 of the Senate to get rid of him. So it's kind of more bluster than anything from Leo, although it seems to land pretty tangibly, palpably with Hoynes.
It used to be that you would vote for the president, and whoever got the most votes was the president. Whoever got the second most votes was the vice president.
Right. That led to a mess almost immediately, I think, with John Adams and Jefferson. And I want to say the 12th Amendment revamped how the Electoral College worked in terms of the vice presidency.
Well, let me consult Article 2 of the Constitution, because I'm not 100% sure where this office gets the authority to direct me to the men's room.
Is it weird that we're discussing the middle of the episode?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We didn't go in chronological order. The very beginning is Mandy. Mandy with her terrible driving again.
Again, yeah, again with her.
It's clearly a character thing. She basically drives up onto the curb to confront Russell, her boyfriend / employer, with, I think, another, this is another situation where we don't exactly know what they're talking about. It becomes clear that Josh Lyman behind the scenes has made a deal with Russell. He'll give him some sort of spotlight position at the convention, and Russell will perhaps even be the one to nominate Bartlett for a second term. And Russell's just gone for it, much to Mandy's chagrin.
Yeah.
And it leads to, I know is one of your favorite lines of West Wingdom, and it is...
I drink from the keg of glory, Donna. Bring me the finest muffins and bagels in all the land.
One of the things that I love also is this so stupid, as not only is he drinking from the keg of glory, he then turns to the bullpen and beats his chest.
That is a, I think, quintessentially Brad Whitford-ism. That's not English, but it's a quintessential Brad Whitford moment, beating his chest like an effeminate gorilla.
Does he Is that okay? This is where I'm going to ask you your insider info. Is that in the stage directions? Would that be in the script?
I think not. I think that would be Brad on the day. And I can't tell you, lo these many years later, as a Jew, I eat a lot of bagels, and I've been at many brunches where that line of dialogue has been invoked.
Oh, I'm
many,
sure.
Many.
I can't look at a bagel or a muffin without thinking of it. The inspiration for Josh Lyman was supposedly Rahm Emanuel.
Hmm. Hmm.
He used to be a staffer in the Clinton administration, and he had sort of this reputation of being the enforcer.
The bulldog.
He was the bulldog, yeah. Have you ever seen The Thick of It?
Love it.
He was basically their Malcolm.
Right.
I'm explaining the inspiration of a TV show from a real person by invoking a different TV show.
It's beautiful, and I like it, and I endorse it.
He helped Bill Clinton win in 92, and then he became a part of the administration, and he was like a senior advisor for strategy. And so he would be somebody who just terrorized Republicans and Democrats alike. Actually, one of my favorite things that somebody ever said about him was then Senator Obama.
It hasn't been easy for Rahm, though. As a young man, he had a serious accident. I think many of you are aware of this. He was working in a deli. Accident with a meat slicing machine. He lost part of his middle finger. As a result of this, this rendered him practically mute.
That's very funny. It's a good line.
It's a good line. And so that's sort of the kind of personality that Josh is supposed to be inspired by. The funny thing is, Rahm Emanuel's brother is Ari Emanuel.
Right.
Also inspired a TV character, Ari Gold from Entourage.
That is true. Look at those two guys. And did we note that between being mayor of Chicago and in the Clinton administration, he was, of course, Obama's chief of staff.
Right, exactly.
And then we get, it's worth noting, the first shot at the real Snuffy Walden West Wing theme, correct?
Yeah, although in my mind, this is not yet the real theme.
It's not fully fleshed out, is it? Talk to me, music man. What's the story?
Well, this is like the beta version. I think maybe all the instruments aren't real yet. Like, there's still some MIDI electronic instruments, and it's not a full orchestra. You can especially notice it in this one part. It'll change a little bit later in the season, and I think that version is really the iconic one that people know and love.
Ah, and let me just see how close attention you've been paying. WG Snuffy Walden, the WG stands for?
William Garrett?
Yes, you really studied your episode one. I hope everybody at home got that too.
All right. So in this teaser, we get all this information about Josh that he's like so politically savvy and he's really cocky about it too. He's a sore winner.
Yeah, that's true. He's a terrible winner and a terrible loser, we will learn in this episode, because he's not excited about the possibility of Mandy coming on board, and spends much of the episode trying to get everyone else to promise that if they hire a media consultant, it will not be Mandy.
Yeah, that's the most beautiful part about this is by winning this, he's sealed his fate, as now he has to do the thing that he doesn't want, which is work alongside his ex-girlfriend.
Correct.
So Mandy's now out of a job.
I think she and Daisy.
Yeah. And so we meet Daisy Reese, who is her coworker.
Played by Meryn Dungey, it should be noted, who now plays Ursula in Once Upon a Time. She was also on the show Alias. And her sister, Channing Dungey, just recently became the new president of ABC Entertainment. So she is technically my boss. So a big salute and a tip of the hat to both Meryn and Channing Dungey.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, and because unfortunately, this is her first and only appearance. The way that the episode goes, it sounds like Josh has given them both a job, and yet we never see Daisy Reese again.
No, that is true. I wonder what that's all about. When did Alias start?
But in their exchange, we get a good resume recap from Mandy.
I have a PhD. Did you know that?
Yes. Some people don't know that.
I do.
I've got a bachelor's degree in art history and a master's degree in communications and a PhD in political science.
We find out a bunch of information about Bartlett as well.
Jed Bartlett, Nobel laureate in economics, three-term congressman, two-term governor.
You get a lot of backstory just in that one sentence.
It's actually a nice little character insight about Josh that he's been fighting their hiring her the entire episode, but when it's finally clear to him that that's how it's going down, he wants to show up and actually bring her on board. He seems to actually kind of enjoy that he's helping her out. Also, maybe there's a little bit of twist of the knife, too, that, like, she needs him. He's coming to her rescue. And, of course, he also wants to reiterate that she will be answering to him and to Toby, something that he's repeated to great comic effect several times earlier in the episode. And do you detect that he's also, I guess, on some level still carrying a little torch? I mean, the fact that it bothers him so much, the idea of being around his ex-girlfriend, does that maybe indicate that he's the flame's alive?
I mean, I think we get a little bit of sense of that even in the pilot, just by how he takes the news that she's dating Senator Russell. Our first walk and talk, I think, of the episode is following Leo and this guy, Morris Tolliver. Actually, the walk and talk stays with Morris. It tracks on his walk. And he comes in and he's the president's physician.
You like him immediately.
Yeah. He's a new dad. He's humble about his rank, but not so humble that he doesn't, you know, sass the president.
Yeah, I know. It's actually which is illuminating both of his character and of the president's that he takes it. I mean, he is self-deprecating often, Bartlett, but he even allows this sort of fairly low ranked Navy doctor to tease him about having a 3% approval rating. So they have a nice, you can see they have a real bond.
Yeah. And the key, I think, is what Leo says. He feels better after he's talked to you. I think there have been days when you've lightened the load a little.
Right. And of course, I've seen the episode before, but the first time I saw it was 17 years ago. So I couldn't quite remember what the fate of Captain Morris Tolliver, MD, was, but when Leo asked him the names of his wife and newborn daughter, I thought, oh dear. And then when the president actually asks Morris his wife's name and the kid's name, I thought, oh, well, he's clearly going to die.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I don't know that I thought that the first time I saw it. I was saying on the rewatch, I didn't remember that he died, but then that's what keyed it for me. I'm like, oh, it's getting really personal. Nothing good is going to come of this for Captain Morris Tolliver. The second time somebody asked his wife and child's name, I thought, this is going to gut-wrench me later because I know his kid's name.
Right. So this is your signal that he was a red shirt. You know that term?
I don't. I'm just going to admit my ignorance.
red shirt, like, is what they would call the low-ranked people on Star Trek who would go out and get killed.
I thought I was going to feel stupid because this was some political, poli-sci, historical thing.
No. It's a TV thing.
No, I feel absolutely fine about not knowing your Star Trek reference, Rishi.
It started with Star Trek, and it just sort of means somebody who is a character who's going to only appear in this episode, even though they might have like a line or two, by the end of the episode, they will have been killed.
Right, which is actually kind of brilliantly spoofed in Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
I mean, really not criticizing him, more lauding that in very short screen time, we become attached to this guy, we become attached to Morris's relationship with Bartlett. And so when... Another, as in episode one, we have the Cubans on their rafts off camera. Now this hideous thing is going to happen and the a military transport that Morris is on is going to go down with dozens of other people. And it's going to happen off camera, but it's really going to land for us emotionally when Leo tells the president.
Mr. President, Morris Tolliver is dead. An Air Force transport carrying Morris, 12 other doctors, 42 support staff, and a crew of five to a teaching hospital in Amman exploded in midair about 150 miles north of TARDIS.
One of the things that really landed for me there, in addition to the personal, Bartlett says his first response essentially is, I'm going to call Morris's wife. And I remember thinking, my God, what a horrible job to be President of the United States, because how many moments in reality does a president have to deal with these kind of devastating tragedies And in addition to making decisions of life and death, he also has to engage in these horribly painful personal moments with people all the time.
Yeah.
And I also think there's actually something very, very interesting going on. There's a long moment of Bartlett considering, and his response is,
I'm going to blow them off the face of the earth with the fury of God's own thunder.
I think it's a very nice, complex moment because part of you goes, yeah, like, get him. But you also see in Leo's face, is this really the right response? And is the president, who earlier in the episode admitted to some trepidation even about being in the same room with the Joint Chiefs, now he's got this sudden determination, but it's also motivated by the personal and Morris and this dear friend who's been killed. And is he making the right decision? Determination is great, but you also got to be right. It's a great piece of acting from yeah. John Spencer and from Martin.
And now we're going to take a quick break. And now back to the show. We get the first taste of the president's hokey dad or granddad humor. Morris is going to Amman, and the president says, you should stay here. We've got Amman, a woman, little kids. You know, it's just...
And yeah, that's actually recurring. That's like the D plot of this episode, is that Bartlett has a questionable sense of humor. I think even when post hoc ergo propter hoc is invoked, it's Bartlett's way of saying, I didn't lose Texas in the primaries because I made a bad joke about hats. Right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's even, that's his defense. Yeah, maybe I have a bad sense of humor, but I don't think it's affecting me politically.
And these are all kind of intertwined. He's got a corny sense of humor. He speaks Latin. He's a Nobel laureate. And I feel like, you know, that kind of joke, the Amman, a woman, you know, that kind of punning is the kind of thing that a certain kind of mind can't help but do. It's just like the wordplay shows up and then it comes out.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. Clearly, Bartlett loves language. That is true.
Exactly. I don't think we actually know what the joke is. They keep referring to the joke. The Ryder Cup team has declined to come to the invitation to the White House.
And, that's another... It's
because of the joke.
Yeah, and it's a classic Sorkin, but I'm not going to tell you what the joke is.
Right.
We also get Bartlett's first jacket flip. Martin Sheen's unique way of donning a jacket. But I'm sure, as most people know by now, that are wing nuts. That is a result of a shoulder injury that I think Martin sustained as a very young child or maybe even as a baby. And it's really the only way he can get a jacket on.
Isn't one of his arms actually shorter than the other?
I'll tell you, Rishi, I never measured because that seemed like a really personal thing to ask someone. But no, I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, it's right. His left arm, after that accident, it's 3 inches shorter than his right arm.
Wow, that's significant.
Yeah, that's why he puts on the jacket that way. And then I think the other big story in this episode is Sam and Laurie continued. We're picking up where the pilot left off, where Sam had slept with Laurie. He finds out that she is a call girl, which no one else can know because that would look really bad, though he didn't pay for sex with her. He didn't commit a crime, but she's somebody who's engaged in, technically, in criminal activity.
It wouldn't look good.
So the best course of action would be for him to forget about it, for him to never speak to her again, and, you know, politely go their separate ways, and hopefully nobody's ever the wiser. But he doesn't want to let it go, and I find this so annoying.
It is annoying, his behavior.
Yeah, the whole thing is just like, come on, man. Like, he's going to try and reform her or save her. And
which everyone is absolutely busting him on. I think Toby says it and Josh says it. And he denies each time, no, that's not what I'm looking to do. But clearly that is the sort of end game he has in mind.
For some reason, despite the fact that this guy is, you know, one of the top political strategists in the country, he's going to go against what everybody else is telling him and let his moral indignation guide the way. Yeah, and so then he goes and tracks her down. She's on the job. I don't know, he's such a jackass the whole time about this thing that I'm like sick of him. And I can't believe that she, at the end of it, you know, she's like, you humiliated me. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely he did. She's just so taken aback by everything. She has, if you, like, she just leaves.
Sam, in addition to introducing himself, then essentially threatens the two, I guess, Johns at the table. You're not going to get in touch with my friend, the assistant attorney general, right? I mean, just a huge, like, just completely out of line on every level in terms of his own security and that of the administration and the atrocious way that he's treating Lori.
But he stays the course and then manages to win her over really quickly. Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. No. Shouting at the screen. No. Don't. Give him the coat back and leave.
Yeah, you're supposed to be rooting for Sam in this moment. And the whole time, you're just like, get out of there. Molly, you in danger, girl.
That's true.
I just have to say that there's something that, as much as I love the show, as much as I love this episode, I'm definitely uncomfortable with some parts of this plot. Like the fact that when it comes to Lori, it's just Sam, Josh, and Toby.
They do not include CG, right?
Right.
Absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Right, but...
You are such a Miranda, but go ahead.
I still don't know what that means.
Go ahead, make your point. Make your proto-feminist point.
My point is that there seems to be a lot of saving of women in this episode. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't get to decide their own fate necessarily. They get bailed out. CJ gets bailed out by Leo, and Mandy gets bailed out by Josh, and Sam goes and rescues Lori. And it just feels like sort of the men get to have a lot of agency and a lot of the women are kind of...
No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay, Mr. Yeah. Sensitive. Yeah.
It just feels like there's a power imbalance there. And it just feels a little patriarchal. But that's pretty much the only thing that I didn't like in the episode. You know, my favorite thing is then the confrontation between Leo and Hoynes, the culmination of this A3, C3 plot line where it does eventually come to blows. It's great. Like, the dialogue is great.
Aaron Redding, classic power politics confrontation is pretty great, with Leo saying,
'Cause I'll win and you'll end up playing celebrity golf the rest of your life.
Classic line of dialogue. Also, I forgot to point out much earlier in the episode the appearance of another Mighty Sorkin player. Victor Love plays the journalist Mike in CJ's press conference up at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, he's the guy who originally asks about the quote from the vice president on A3.
Right, he refers to it as being strained. And Victor played Lance Corporal Harold W. Dawson in the Broadway production of A Few Good Men, written by Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, he's going back.
Yeah, Victor's a great guy and a great actor, so it was fun to see him there. Aaron does like to employ people in a serial fashion.
It's a great episode.
It's a terrific episode of TV, and as all good TV should do, leaves you really dying to watch the next episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had a really hard time not going to the next episode. I'm trying to pace myself for the podcast. You know, I want to wait and watch it right before we're going to have our conversation. So I managed to exert some self-control, but it wasn't easy, and I didn't watch the next episode.
Nor did I. No, Netflix, no. You're not going to start the next episode without asking me.
Here, you know, on Netflix, there is an option where you can turn off autoplay.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, autoplay is a great feature for binge watching, but the one casualty of it, this was pointed out to me by Jeff Beal, the composer from House of Cards, who was on Song Exploder for the music that he made for that show. And he writes these beautiful themes for the closing credits of the show. Or there's like really that's really like a place for, as opposed to The West Wing, where the music is always the same, on a show like House of Cards, the music changes every time. And if you want to actually sit there and appreciate that and kind of be absorbed in the moment a little bit, you actually have to turn off autoplay. Otherwise, it jumps to the next episode 15 seconds before the episode's actually done.
That's a very interesting point that I had never considered.
So I'm going to do that. I'm going to turn autoplay off on my
Can't Netflix. We all, as a podcast, pledge to turn off autoplay? Can't we all do that? Everybody, please raise your right hand and take the following pledge. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, well, that does it for our episode. We'll hope you'll join us next time for episode 3. We'll be joined by a special guest.
How you doing? This is Dule Hill, and I play a character named Charlie Young.
Till then, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Rishi Hirway, and Josh is at Josh Molina. You can also leave a comment for us about this episode on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly, or on our website, thewestwingweekly.com.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.